Okay, how many of you guys are actually collecting data or planning to collect data that you're wanting to donate to Home Bank? Okay, so decent smattering to you at least. Okay, so what I'm going to be focusing on here is sort of the process for that. The process for underlying the collection of data that will lead to the donating of data. Because we'll talk a little bit about like the mechanics of how you donate, but it's actually fairly straightforward because you really just email the Home Bank team and they'll walk you through it. It's not that complicated, but I'll mention the steps. But there's a lot of sort of underlying questions around ethics that Brian alluded to that we'll spend a little bit of time talking to. So first, why donate to Home Bank? Point number one is getting your work out there. So you get a DOI of your data set, which people can cite. People will cite the studies that are related to your data set, and it will improve the visibility of your work. So that's a big positive. But for me, and I think for a lot of other people in Darkle, what we found is that sort of contributing and collaborating and bringing data sets together is really powerful beyond just getting citations for your work. So we really are sort of stronger together, beyond just sharing code and things like that, which is really helpful and important. There's certain types of research questions. The CDS ADS classifier is actually a really good example of that that Alex was just talking about. But there's certain types of research questions that we really can't do until we bring our data sets together. And so if we're all sort of stuck in our own labs, collecting our own data sets, we're really limiting the types of research that we can do. So one of the things that we're starting to focus on right now, afraid to touch this thing now, is looking at cross-cultural comparisons, which is bringing data sets together from different parts of the world and looking at how things are similar and different. The other thing that bringing data sets together allows us to do is to look at populations that are otherwise really challenging to study. So in my lab, we're looking at adolescent parents, and, you know, over the course of several years, we've only managed to collect a very small N of adolescent mothers who are willing to work with us. We have a larger N in the sample that's available because we've extended the age range up to 25. So now it's our young mothers sample. But in terms of actually getting, you know, 15-year-olds, there aren't that many 15-year-olds who are willing to participate. 15-year-old mothers willing to participate in a study in any given city. But if you have lots of researchers around who can collect those kinds of data and bring them together as a data set, even just you happen to get a 17-year-old mom in your sample looking at other things, we can bring those data together and look at questions that are otherwise unavailable to us. And then, of course, there is the increasing expectations that Brian mentioned that we are expected to be sharing our data. And so HomeBank is providing a mechanism for doing it in a way that is sensitive to the technical and ethical considerations that we have when we're collecting these kinds of data sets. Okay, so here's the list of the process for donating. We'll talk about ethics and consent. We'll talk data collection we'll get pushed off to after the break, contacting HomeBank. I'll talk about vetting of files and then sign a contract, just like you sign a contract when you access the data. You also sign a contract when you submit the data, creating the metadata file, and then uploading the files. Okay. So first I have to spend a little time talking about why these recordings really are special. Because sometimes if you're sort of entering into it, and I've had some discussions a while back with Brian about this as well, if you're coming in from the perspective of sort of childless type recordings, you don't necessarily realize what you can actually find in these recordings, especially if you're targeting a vulnerable group like adolescent parents or even parents with kids with cochlear implants or things like that. You can run into things that you're not expecting to find. And think about your own daily lives when you're yelling at your kids or going to the bathroom or doing whatever, right? There's all sorts of things we do in our daily lives that we don't necessarily want to be publicly available on the internet, right? Even if we're fairly, not all that private about our lives. So parents fight, they discuss politics, they go to the bathroom, you know, all of these things appear on these recordings. And because they're really super long recordings, We can, maybe, but we don't necessarily want to necessarily vet everything. That's a question that we can have because it's partly because it's time intensive to go through minute by minute and vet everything, although we are starting to do that for some types of recording. And then the other issue is data loss. So if you're studying adolescent parents and you want to remove absolutely everything that might be a little bit less than perfect for the internet, you're going to lose a lot of what's interesting about that data set, right? So there's considerations there as well. The other thing that is worth thinking about is that our data are not just data. They can also be interpreted as value statements. So Brian was talking about the 30 million word gap, this notion that there are socioeconomic and cultural impacts on how we speak to our kids, and we think about those as being measures of the quality as well as the quantity of speech that children are hearing. And then you start to realize that just the simple recordings themselves are qualitative value statements on people's behavior. And so we have to be, or could be considered so. So we have to be really careful about that. Obviously, these are recordings that involve children and informed consent, something that Brian, again, has dealt with for many years, but it's still there. We have, if you're putting something up on the internet, that child hasn't directly consented to that. That's something worth considering. The other thing that is a little bit different about home bank type recordings versus childless recordings is that because people wander around outside the house with these recorders, there's often incidental bystander recording that takes place. And there are both ethical and legal considerations to that part of things that we don't necessarily consider all that, that takes some thought. And there's differences in different places about what the legal implications are of that. So it's not something that I can tell you what the legal implications are. That's unique to where you're located and what the rules are where you're from. So that's another reason why we have these two versions of HomeBank. One is the fully public on the internet and the other is the more private, because it does preserve a little bit of confidentiality beyond what we, just putting it all out there on the internet. So step one is making sure that you have ethics, that you've thought through the ethics and have consent to share. And that has to go way back. And this is important for anybody who's collecting these kinds of recordings, whether or not you're, obviously we encourage you to donate to HomeBank, but even if you're not going to, it's really, really important to think through these considerations very carefully right from the outset. So here's just some sort of tips and considerations that we've kind of developed over the years in the Darko community. So with respect to consent, one thing is to keep contact information as long as possible. I'll talk briefly about talking to your ethics board, but ethics boards sometimes want you to try and make your data anonymous, and you can't really make audio recordings anonymous. So they're trying to get you to delete your current contact information, and you desperately don't want to do that because you could end up with questions that you want to go back and ask your participants about. And if you've deleted their contact information, you can't do that. So the other thing that in the consent form is another thing to consider is not to restrict the location of the data storage. So sometimes ethics boards want you to be very specific about where you're going to store your data and how that's going to take place. But then the problem is that things change. So things have been changing very rapidly over the last several years, both within HomeBank and outside of HomeBank, and you don't want to be restricted to where your data can be stored by having been very specific about where you said it was going to be stored if things are changing. Right? So the other consideration is where you are planning, if you're going to submit to HomeBank, where you're planning to submit it to. Are you going to put it into the private section or the public section, and part of why that's important is because that'll impact your decisions about what you're asking your participants to consent to and how you're going to vet it and all that sort of thing. Another interesting question that people have differences of opinion about is when to collect the consent to share. So you can do it at the same time that you collect your general consent to participate in the study, or you can collect it after the fact. Right, those are or somewhere between, I suppose, but those are the two main options, right? And there's pros and cons to each of those. If you do it at the same time, then the participants know what they're getting into, right? And they can be aware of that as they're going through the process. That that in itself has pros and cons, right? Because then that might change your behavior. And they know what their recordings are going to be used for. You're not sort of throwing a curveball at them at the end. But if you do it after, then there's going to be less impact on the naturalness of the potentially less impact on the naturalness of the recordings. And participants may be able to make that decision based on knowing what was in the recordings rather than, prospectively sort of, now that they've gone through the experience, they may have a better sense of whether they're comfortable with it or not. Yeah?
I wanted to ask if home writers has a repository of language that has been used with IRB or ethics boards to ask for this consent, or if there's just language available.
Yes, certainly. So there's, I'll get you a link to the resources available in Homebank. There's a sample consent form, recommended consent form. I'll show you a couple examples on the slides as well. And the DARPA community is a great resource for those kinds of questions as well. Yeah.
So I'm always a little concerned when working with communities that I'm not sure understand the implications of what it means to have their data on the internet.
Yeah.
So, in my current project, I have consent to make everything public, but I'm kind of concerned that people that I've worked with may not actually understand what that means because they live in a fairly remote area of Africa. They do have cell phones now, but that's sort of a recent introduction. And I'm not sure whether they really understand what it means to have.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And even in communities where they do have really great familiarity, like with adolescent parents, they have a lot of familiarity with sharing their stuff on the internet, and they make choices that maybe, aren't the safest choices, right? So there's a balance there, I think, between being respectful of your participants' wishes and being comfortable in your own self about what the ethics are of what you're sharing. So there's a question in my lab, for example. We collect consent to share publicly, but we don't share publicly. So I have consent from participants, some of whom have said, "Yeah, it's totally fine. You can share it with whoever you want on the internet, post it on the internet. I don't mind." But I've made the decision not to do that. But what that consent allows me to do is that, if in my judgment, that gives me a much greater flexibility to share with other researchers without having to go back and look at the wording of my consent form. Does this violate what I had asked them to sign? Right. So, you can pull back, and I do personally pull back a little bit from, if you feel that they've agreed to share it really publicly, but you have a level of discomfort with that, you can still put some barriers in place to, you're not obligated to post everything publicly on the public side of Homebank. And Mitty, did you want to say more about getting them some feeling like you understand?
Yeah. And I'm planning on putting my data on Homebank, but what I've worked out with Anne is that, right now you get access to Homebank and there are a couple of corporate in there, but there's actually that she would be okay with having subset of that be sort of special access conditions, and not all Homebank members, but something that you can vet individually and have a little bit more control of your data. So it's still available, posted there, integrated into this whole system of tools that we're going to talk about, but also provides you a little bit more protection of your data so you can, for example, make those decisions that make sense.
Yeah, and one of the things, too, about Homebank is that, we have the public repository and we have the private repository, but Anne is also working very hard to, in special cases like this where there really are special considerations to work with researchers who want to donate to make it work in a way that, that's appropriate for their data set. Yeah.
I think parents are more concerned with the audio recorded data. I'm sorry, video recorded data.
Sometimes,
audio.
Yeah.
Because in the past, my students were looking for, the data. At the end, she had to use her own daughter's in her dissertation.
Uh-huh.
So because of we wanted to analyze the audio, video recording.
Yeah.
Instead of the audio.
Yeah. Yes.
I think it's an issue of The ethics board in my country requires that all data are destroyed on.
Yeah, so that's.
We're trying to go about it by saying full incorporation of this study.
Yeah.
It's some leeway, but I don't know if anyone has been to this and how you manage to, because obviously it's a real picture.
Yeah. Okay. Let me get through a couple more slides and then we'll get back to chatting because some of these issues are in the slides, in the next couple slides. And I don't have any, answers that are going to solve all these problems, right? These are issues that, one of the things that I think is really important is that these are issues that we are still trying to resolve as a larger world society, right? The access that we have to each other's lives. And so we're not going to solve that today in this session. But I think what's important is for us to take the time to think them through and be able to talk to each other and try and work out, and ethics boards are learning just as we are, right? So another sort of key point that, sort of learned from my mistakes, don't make promises that you can't keep. So one of the things with consent forms and talking to parents is that we don't always necessarily know what we're going to end up wanting to do with the data and what technology is going to allow us to do with the data, right? So technology is changing very rapidly. Things that we couldn't do 10 years ago, we can now do. There's new standards that come into place in both ways, right? Some areas are pushing for everything needs to be deleted. Some are pushing for everything needs to be shared, and some are pushing for both at the same time. So these new standards, data sharing, new laws about what you're allowed to share and how you can share it and what participants' rights are and that sort of thing are changing all the time. So we just have to try and be flexible about those kinds of things. So talking with parents, try and keep it simple. There's lots of kind of technical issues about, what are the security measures that we can put in place with the data and, what types of, how much data we're going to share and who we're going to share it with and what are the different types of researchers and what their access is going to be. And there's all these sort of levels of technical complexity about what we can do with the data. But parents are most, for the most part, not interested in and don't have the level to understand that stuff. So it's really try and keep it very, very simple in your wording. And the consent form that HomeBank has as a suggestion, I think, does a very good job of that. The other thing about talking to parents is that it's nice to kind of involve them in the process. They're interested in these issues, too, because, like I just said, they're more global than just our audio recordings. So in my newsletters to parents, I try and talk about sort of the big data issue and what we're doing in our research community to try and deal with these things, right? So that helps them to feel involved. So we've already mentioned a couple of these issues dealing with adolescent parents. Consent with adolescent parents in particular is interesting because we have laws about, who's allowed to consent that get a little bit fuzzy when an adolescent is a parent because we have these the mature minor doctrine that comes into play in some places where if they've shown a level of maturity, then they start to be able to make decisions for themselves. And that gets very complicated. And in particular, if somebody's making decisions for their own child, that starts to be evidence that gets used to say that they're capable of consenting for that child. So when I first started out collecting these data with adolescent parents, every participant mother who was less than 18, I had them, their parent or guardian sign a special form, and we realized this was really problematic because they were, first of all, incredibly insulted by that, some of them. And others, it just wasn't practical because they really were living their own lives and there wasn't somebody who was the appropriate person to sign that form. So that's something that that's one particular. And then they're very transient, so consent is difficult with them because they may give you 3 recordings and then disappear on you. So what happens to those recordings if they've disappeared on you, right? Do you still have consent to use them? So transient populations can be challenging for that. indigenous populations which people are interested in studying. There are ethical and legal and other special considerations, often for getting community involvement. And in Canada, and I assume in other places as well, there, we have very specific ethics regulations on how you do research involving Indigenous populations. And then, as Monica mentioned, working with communities who are less familiar with the Internet and what the implications are of collecting these recordings and putting them on the Internet, it poses its own special challenges. So I do have a few tips for dealing with the ethics board, and this actually is something that can sometimes come into play even if you're just using HomeBank and not donating to HomeBank, so hopefully this will be a little bit of interest to those of you who aren't planning to do this. One thing that I think is really important that you might not realize is that you are actually the expert here. Now, I'm not saying that you necessarily want to tell your ethics board that, because they may disagree, but in reality, you probably have spent more time thinking about these particular issues and have more knowledge about what the underlying considerations are than your ethics board does. And some ethics boards are sort of cognizant of this, and some of them are not. So ethics boards like to have these sort of cookie-cutter approaches of they'll give you a template consent form or template ideas about how data storage is going to take place and things like that. And this can be really, really problematic for data sharing of home bank-type recordings because it's not a good fit. So one of the biggest challenges is what somebody was just bringing up about deleting data, right? There's this push to make data, particularly the challenge that I think is most, other than just completely deleting all the data, a lot of ethics boards want you to delete contact information and make your data anonymous. And the reality is that audio recordings cannot be anonymous, right? They just can't be. So you don't want to end up in a position where you're trying to make your data anonymous and all you've accomplished is now you have data that you can't, that you don't have appropriate access to.
Concerns, the one about deleting data and absolutely anonymous, you know, there's a lot can't. These things are actually changing, and the government is really loosening up on this, at least in the States.
Yeah, but things are changing very quickly.
And,
yeah.
You know, this notion of disruption has almost totally vanished now. in the States.
Yeah, so it varies from place to place.
The anonymity is still somewhat in float.
So in my experience, different, you know, people are going to have different experiences, but in my experience is if you make a good case for, don't feel intimidated by your ethics board, like the worst thing that they're going to say is no. So make a good case to them. If they're telling you something that you think isn't appropriate for your data set, tell them that and tell them why, right? And often ethics boards will respond to that. Now, if you're really in a position where they're being recalcitrant, then you know there's nothing you can do. But ethics boards really do respond to logic most of the time, right? They're people like you and me. So, yeah.
And if you already have an NFT approval, actually, and you say that you will keep the data inside your lab and everything, and now I would like to share the data, so you just advise to make a new project for only sharing the data, and so making a new ethics approval just for that.
For ongoing research, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, so there is...
For sharing the same data.
No,
for sharing the same data.
You got consent, but
yeah.
Didn't say it was going to be shared.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And now you want to share. So it depends on how it was said. If you said other researchers can have it, then that's okay. But if you said only my lab can have it, then you've got to go back to the people and you have to get a new consent.
Well, and that's why I'm saying, so if you said your data are going to only be stored in your lab, then you're kind of stuck, right, without going back and getting further permission, which you can do if you have their contact information and they haven't moved. You've said you're going to keep the data in your lab, you can't just sort of change your mind on that, but... sometimes you're just stuck and have to say, okay, well, that was a bad idea. I'm going to change my consent form. Going forward, I'm going to change my
permissions. The point is, don't do that.
But, yeah,
don't
so
say
try not to.
The data will only be in my lab and no one else will ever look at it.
Yeah, yeah.
It will be available to researchers or to whom I could.
Yeah, and most participants are really open to that, too. So it's not like, it's easier to pull back than to open up, right? you can always say, well, I got my participants to agree to this, but I'm not really sure I feel comfortable with that agreement. You can pull back. But if you have this very restrictive consent, then there's no way, without going back and finding them and reconsenting, to open it back up. Okay, so here's the home bank consent form. So if you go to homebank.talkbank.org, you can go to just that link there. You can click on the home bank link to, I'll show you where to get to it in a moment. You can just go to there if you want to look at it yourself. This is the sort of home bank approved consent form, which just basically very quickly lays out the recordings and questionnaire information may be included in a password-protected database for use by researchers at other institutions who have completed ethical training and have agreed not to share with other people. So very simple wording. And then here, this is the one that, opens it up to the general public and then talks about, sort of very briefly, about the vetting, right? So obviously there's a lot more detail into what this actually means than is here, but this gets very quickly at the guts, the very basics of what's important. And, yes, this is the English version. So this is the template, the starting point. So this is the home bank approved one. I have a couple other examples here that I have from prior versions of this talk. This is a consent form that Elika Bergelson has used in the past. I think she's updated hers as well. And it's more of a, like, choose your own adventure kind of. And this is one where she has video recordings as well. So there's that extra complexity. You notice that there's room for multiple names here because you're going to have lots of adults, right? So that's a consideration as well. Are you going to try and consent absolutely everybody that ends up in the recordings, or are you going to treat some people as incidental bystander recordings? And in a lot of places, that's okay as long as certain considerations fall into place. Like sometimes it's if they know they're being recorded. Sometimes it's if it's public, then it's public, right? That sort of thing. And then here's one that I had used in the past. There's some stuff here that I would change, though, so I wouldn't. You can look at it as sort of inspiration, but I wouldn't necessarily use that one in its form, in its current form, because I've updated mine considerably since then. So other questions about consent and ethics? Yeah. No, very much not. What we're looking for is the audio recordings, and this originally, well before we even connected with Brian and the TalkBank community, it started as a project to sort of collect WAVE and ITS files. So the ITS files are sort of the output files from Lena, so that we could try and share its files, and do analysis on those. Now that we've sort of merged in with the TalkBank community, and in part to make, for people who are wanting to do transcription and to facilitate, convergence with client and chat, we have a chat version. It's essentially a chat version of the its file, for those of you who are using Lena, that Brian created. So it's a conversion that you can do in Lena to... take the its file and convert it to a chat format. So, I said Lena, not in Lena. Yeah, definitely not in Lena. Sorry, I said Lena. I meant Clan. I apologize. Definitely don't use the conversion in Lena because it's bad. So go to Clan and do the conversion there. But you can just send your. I think you could just send your its files and they would convert it on their side. You don't need to send the chat files because they're the same as the its files unless you've actually done transcription.
Very simply, you have to say a 4-letter abbreviation for every child so that we know we're in sync. So we know you say, 0825 or AB19.
Uh-huh.
And that's all we need. For each child, yep. Has to have a 4-letter pseudonym, the anonymy.
Yeah. So some people aren't using Lena recordings, and so whatever you have, we're interested in, right? If you have some sort of, Elan based transcription, we'll figure something out, right? But
I'm not Lena, so what's in those X files?
Right. So, okay, I don't have a good slide for that, but essentially the if files are going to have it's an XML formatted file that just sort of specifies, you know, this for each sort of chunk of the audio form, it's going to provide sort of like starting and stopping points of segments, and then what the labels are for that segment, and then some basic information about the segment that the software has.
But if you're not a lady user, you don't want to know anything about them. You just don't even care.
Yeah.
Well,
maybe I do care about what's in them, and if I can get them some other way, maybe the same information.
Yeah. I think Alex is going to talk about some stuff related to, you know, what is the information that you can actually get out of the Lena software and what you can.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so step two is your data. So you've got your ethics and consent. Step two is data collection, which is for after the lunch. So the next thing you're ready to contribute. So here's the front page, homebank.talkbank.org, if you want to follow along in your laptop. So if you click on this contributing data link, you get to a page that looks like this, and that has a bunch of links in here that are relevant. You can see the example consent form here. You can see more information described in these here links. And then there's an explanation of the process, which is in part what we'll be going through. Okay, so I've listed step three as contact home bank. Now that you have your data and you want to contribute it, but feel free to contact home bank earlier than that if you have, like, it's as I hope I've been sort of reinforcing, the sort of ethics consent side of things is one of the key pieces that ends up being stumbling blocks for people. So please do feel free to contact home bank at any point in the process if you have questions. Or the Darkle community, we're always sort of happy to help and provide advice and feedback. So the next step would be vetting. So we've been sort of throwing out this term, and it's a term I'm not sure that everybody's sort of familiar with, but the idea is in vetting the recordings, we use this term to refer to listening through the audio to ensure that the content is appropriate to be sharing either super publicly or even just within the research community. So there's a couple considerations there's two main things that we're looking for in vetting the audio. One is that, you know, people's, you know, real full contact information and credit card numbers and social security numbers and things like that doesn't appear in the recording. And then the other side of things is that it's not a source of embarrassment or danger to the participant. So if they're talking about illegal activities in the recording, which does happen, or people engaging in bathroom or bedroom activities that show up in the recordings. So that's what we're looking for, to remove those things when they reach a threshold that we think they need to be removed. Yeah? Yeah, that would probably be something that we would, it depends on what's said, right? So you have to sort of think of the specifics of the particular statement, but immigration status would be the type of thing that we would be concerned about whether it should appear. If it's something that might impact them negatively as a participant, that somebody else were to hear that, it could be used legally against them. Divorce, you know, things that you might be worried might be used in some sort of divorce proceeding or immigration proceeding or something. Obviously, those would be things that we would be concerned about. So Mark Van Dam, the other home bank, so there are two, you know, people who didn't, and who are actually the main players beyond Brian, who are the home bank team. It's really Brian, Mark Van Dam, and Moore Lamont. Neither Mark or Anne are able to be here today, but Mark is the one who's developing the vetting manual, and there's been a lot of behind-the-scenes discussion, both in the Darkle community and within Home Bank itself about what should and shouldn't be vetted, and that's back to that whole ethical consideration that people do really have very different opinions about what is embarrassing and what is sufficiently embarrassing that it shouldn't be available to other people and that kind of thing. So one of the things that's really important is that, you know, Home Bank has its own policies, but as a researcher, you're still responsible for your own recordings, right? So you have to make the decision about what you're comfortable with and that fits with what you've worked out with your ethics board and with your participants is what you're going to do with your recordings. So if you're doing something, so Home Bank has sort of like a basic standard. If you're doing something that's different from that, you should document it so that people who are using your recordings know what you've done with your recordings. And then just sort of the practical detail, the idea is that you mark, and within a CLAN file, you would mark a particular segment for deletion. So here's where you would be using a CLAN file if you're going to be doing this vetting in your own house. You would do it within the chat file and mark it using the silence command to edit out that portion of the audio. So this can be done in-house before contributing the audio files to Home Bank, or it can be done by Home Bank in any files that are appearing in the public side of things, like that Van Damme corpus, will be fully vetted, and that means listening to the entirety of the recordings, which is which takes a lot of time. Okay, so the vetting manual can be found if you go to the main page by clicking here on the vetting manual. So essentially, vetting involves listening through the audio to ensure that, I went backward, that's why. Ah, here it is. Okay, so here's the vetting manual. So the highlights of the vetting manual, like I said, this is a minimum bar. The expectation is that for some populations, you're going to want to take a more rigorous standard than what the vetting manual specifies. And it's a CLAN-based process. And essentially, the way that it works is there's three levels. There's cut one, which means this definitely needs to go. We don't want this appearing in public. Cut two, which is I'm not really sure about this. This one kind of tweaks my buttons a little bit, but I'm not really sure if it reaches the threshold that it should be removed. And then do not cut is just you don't mark it. So the process of marking things as cut one or cut two will remove the audio, but it the what you do with the transcription is up to you. So if you are vetting something and there's something that needs to be deleted from the audio, if there's something that needs to be deleted from a transcription, that's you just delete it from the transcription and then make a comment that it's been deleted. Okay. So the main purpose of kind of the cut two level is that these are borderline cases that then need to be further discussed. So things shouldn't stay at the cut two level. Okay, so here's the format from the... Okay, why is this not... All right, it froze again. This? Here?
No, the other one.
Here? Okay. Okay.
Maybe I went to VGA and then changed that. Yeah, it's ignoring me fully. Okay.
This is exciting.
Okay. I know. I'm just going to do exactly the same thing at this time, hopefully hoping that it will work. Sorry, that one.
I think maybe it doesn't like it's going back.
I think it's just... Maybe we'll try your computer, Brian, next time, because obviously it's not extremely happy. Yeah, this is even worse. That's the end.
I think the computer is not the problem, because the computer knows it's connected, right?
Yeah.
It goes like that.
Yep.
Brian, do you want us to try your computer?
I don't know if I have the presentations
okay.
In the right one. I mean, I could put them there, but...
they're just online where you access the, when you upload, where you're uploading them. Remember?
So from the Google Doc. Okay,
so now it's looking at that one.
Okay. If we have to. We'll
okay. So it's a different one.
So we do this like this.
It's a bit clean.
So this is going to make any difference. Let's find out.
Well, it's actually working.
Yeah, but not at the presentation.
No, that's
true. Can you find that on the web?
Yes.
Because, I mean, I'm on the web here.
Yeah, so if you go to maybe...
Get my mouse.
It's the one part of my talk where I actually...
You actually need it.
I don't. I mean, yeah. It's just a little example.
Maybe I can try the title. Sometimes it remembers. And, here. So it doesn't actually remember.
He's not finding it on the web. Where is it on the web?
Well, I was hoping it would remember. Okay, let me try this.
Is this what you want? Isn't it this thing here? The slides thing?
Excellent. Yeah. Now you can click on that one. Wonderful. Okay, save.
Maybe.
Save. Excellent.
Maybe. Don't bet on it.
Well, we'll see. At least we'll have an n equal 2 participant computer. A participating computer. So present. Yeah. So it's 2 buttons from the blue one. You see? Yeah.
Okay. All right. So here's the form, and it's actually fairly straightforward. So if you're, I'm not going to chat super ill, but so this would be a line of transcription. And then after the period or the question mark or whatever, you just put in square brackets a plus and then cut one or cut two. And then if you have a media bullet, it would come after this. So that's the basic format. And so it's pretty simple. If you hear something or there's something in the transcript that should be deleted in the audio, then you just make that mark and then run the silence thing over it, and that'll template. We would welcome feedback on the manual for anybody who's going to be using these files or going to be donating files that's still under development. But what we've come to for now is that cut one is essentially basic identifying information, including the full name, not the first name, phone number, address, credit card number, social security number, that kind of stuff. And then this is the part, and that's pretty straightforward. This is the part that's generated the most discussion and differences of opinion. But essentially, any admissions of illegal behavior, let's go smoke a joint.
It although that's
becoming, yes,
I mean,
that's becoming less of an issue.
This is not always the big one.
Okay, some other drug that is not illegal. Negative statements about other people, like I can't stand Susan's shrill voice. And then significant medical information, like I can no longer fill my IUD. Things that we've decided definitely do not cut are things like names of large institutions or city names, common personal names and first names, discussion of scatological functions, obscenity and profanity, and minor arguments. Okay, major arguments you might want to delete. But there's a lot of gray area in the middle of that that is very challenging to know. And so that's where Home Bank is developing its own standards, but you may decide that you have standards that are different from Home Bank. And that's okay. Yeah.
I think for me, there are 2 levels. The first one is you want to open that to the researcher.
Yeah.
And number 2 is open that in your article if you want to publish it. right?
Yeah.
They're too liberal. Now, if you look at the about the choice, you know, if you put that in an article that
yeah.
John says this,
yeah.
it's not identical. I mean, I'm sorry, it cannot be identified who Josh or John is.
Yeah, right.
So you, as long as you put his voice in it.
Yes, yeah, sure. And that's,
but
yeah.
But if you present that in writing,
yeah.
so no one can identify who John is.
Yeah, although you do have to be a little bit careful about that because people could potentially take something from your article and figure out who it was in the recording.
I mean,
so you could patch it back. But that does raise, you know, there's also the public versus private, right? So this is the vetting manual that's being developed for what's going to actually end up public, right? And there may be things that, you know, are okay within the private community, but you don't really want fully on the internet, right? And then obviously you can have a standard that's higher than that. And that's okay.
That reminds
yeah.
me of one article by Don Zimmerman,
uh-huh.
who talks about, you know, the conversation among with smokers. And
yeah.
he published that probably 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. He transcribed everything, but, you know, it's a transcription.
Yeah, so yes, but so if it's only the transcription, right,
mm-hmm.
that's different. But the problem is that most of this stuff is associated with audio as well, and even if you delete the audio of that particular line of transcript, you're still going to have the audio of who the speaker is, right? So you haven't fully, just by deleting the waveform audio, you haven't really made that anonymous in the same way that if only had the transcript, it would be anonymous, right?
If you don't know these people, so one of the things that's a problem with small communities like Iceland, where everybody knows each other, the smaller the language, more likely that people will know each other, but in North America, Americans, I mean, have no idea who these people are, you know? So unless you really are their cousin, then you know, of course.
Yeah, okay, but in the private, that's fine for the research community, right, that you can
yeah.
sort of have an expectation that you probably won't know who that person is. But if it's going publicly on the web with new search features and things like that, we can't guarantee that that's going to stay.
Right.
I don't think we can rely on that. But this is probably a discussion we can have, you know, during the break or something, because we've had lots of discussions about this, and there isn't a single answer that everybody agrees with. All right, so back to you're in the steps of donating. So once you're actually ready to donate, things have been vetted on your side that you're comfortable with, you go to the contribution form, and this is just a contract that you sign, and this looks like it's now, is this changed, Brian? Is it now an institution-to-institution form, or this is still the researcher to...
I'm not sure.
Okay, this is the one that I pulled this off the web. In any case,
this is the
original one.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a...
A couple sentences changed.
Okay. So there's been discussion about whether contracts need to be between institutions. That's the position that Databury has taken, that it's institution-to-institution, and that's for legal reasons. Whereas some others want those contracts to be researcher to researcher. And so so Brian's been sort of fiddling with the consent form, I guess, to try and make it more, a little bit, but it's still basically between the
researcher
has
contributed to the data.
Yeah, okay. So this is just describing the data set, Yeah, so this is your contract with Brian when you...
CMU.
With CMU,
okay. CMU can have this data.
Okay. Okay, so special situations that arise with the contract is, as I was just saying, some ethics boards and researchers want the contract to be between institutions, and so you can talk with us if that's a concern for you. A higher risk participant corpora, so you just want to make sure that you have the consent that you're comfortable with. We do have a few cases, including Elke Bergelsen's, for example, where we have both audio and video, and we've been working with Databury to sort of collaborate with them in situations where people want to contribute stuff to Databury as well as to Homebank. And then there's other issues that are starting to arise, like people have. So there's lots of things, like if you're collecting you know, MCDIs or something like that, you can just put that in the metadata. But if you have some more complicated type of data that is, you know, of the nature of like an audio, like Monica was mentioning, things can get a little bit more complicated. But just, you know, email the Homebake team and they'll try and work out a solution for you. Okay. So the next step would be to fill out the metadata form. So there's three levels to the metadata form. There's the corpus level, which is describing the nature of your corpus, who should be acknowledged, what should be cited, if there are any restrictions on use. So you can actually donate portions of a, for example, donate a data set that you're still working with and put restrictions on how it gets used. So for the adolescent study, for example, we're happy to have you use those recordings to look at issues that aren't related to adolescent mothers, but if you're going to publish something about adolescent mothers using my data set, we're not ready for that because we haven't published yet. So those kinds of restrictions you can put in there. Then there's the participant level information. So what is their permission level? Are they preterm? Are they hearing impaired? Other kinds of things like MCDI information, that kind of thing can go in this level. And then the recording level information. So the name of the recording, the age of the child, and any other information that's important to know about that recording. Okay, and I guess we've already sort of talked about this. So what files can I upload? So WAV or MP3 files of large-scale audio recordings. If you have video-based or smaller or particularly lab-based recordings, it may make more sense to send them to Childess, or if it's a video-based thing to Databury, but we'll talk with you and work with you to figure out what's the best place to put your files. In terms of other files, if you have the Lena Itz files, send those. And if you have CLAN annotations, then obviously send us your chat formatted annotations. But don't send chat files, and specifically don't try and export things using the Lena export feature because it doesn't do the right thing. Darkle annotation scheme files, which we'll talk about in a minute, which is currently, this is a new development. Okay, once that's all done, then your data will appear, as Alex had mentioned, in the database. And if you click on Index to Corpora, you see this nice listing of the data sets that are available. And then if you click on one of these corpus links here, you'll end up with a very pretty website.
I thought you'd click on the divot. That would be.
Well, yeah. this is, Anne's corpus. I thought I'd give a shout-out to the person who's been putting the Herculean amount of effort into Homebank, who isn't here to get the kudos for all the work that she's put into it. So this is the Wurlamont corpus. And then if you can follow along on your laptop, you can scroll down and see the rest of the information that's available for each file.
Go down a little bit.
This is a screenshot.
Oh, screenshot. Oh, no, you're not online.
I'm not. Yeah, I didn't actually put a link. So, but you can. Yeah, you can definitely do that. And okay, so I think that was everything.